Hello and welcome to MECS Research Today, the show that's dedicated to discussing new developments and research in the fields of education, music, science, and technology. I'm your host, Daniel Shalagowski, and today we're going to talk about music and technology with Dr. Teresa Marin Nakra. We'll discuss some of her research relating to computer-human interfaces, music perception, and effective computing. She's an associate professor of music and interactive multimedia at the College of New Jersey. So to kick things off, let's have a message from our sponsors. I'd prefer to keep it at the beginning of the episode just to keep things moving and so that there's nothing in between the discussions.
Right. So before you get to ask me questions, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about yourself. Would that be all right?
Yeah. Is there anything particular you'd like to have me discuss?
Yeah, I'd love to know how you ended up. I think you talked about your conducting studies a little bit and how that led you to technology. But I'd love to just hear a little bit more about that and maybe where you are in the process. Are you currently in a grad program?
Yeah, I'm actually in both. I'm kind of in the middle of a weird situation. So I ended up, when I was in high school, I just happened to like equally love computer science and choir. And when I decided to apply for college, I was like, well, there's no computer science education major. And I was like, well, I want to teach computer science. So I was like, well, you know, I'll major in music education. And then, you know, I'll just add on, you know, the additional licensure afterward. Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing a double minor program. And then I found out from one of the graduate coordinators that they have a 4+1 program. Mm-hmm. So you can actually take 9 credits of your master's during your undergrad. And then, you know, once you start your master's, you're already, you know, a third of the way there pretty much. So I'm basically at that point. And then this fall I'll be in the full-time program as I'm student teaching.
Wow. So you're student teaching in music.
Yeah. Yeah. And then this following spring, as I'm finishing up my master's degree, I'll probably do like the praxis exam because that's all I need to get my secondary licensure. And then my goal is basically be AP certified. That way, you know, a little bit more marketable and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm interested in teaching collegiate level stuff. So
including theory.
Right.
AP theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, we definitely do have a lot of overlapping interests.
Yeah. So yeah, great. That's really, well, really just a matter of me being indecisive.
I like to say that I get easily bored.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It's nice having 2 hobby jobs.
Yes. Certainly passion for what you do, right? You clearly love both aspects.
Right.
I guess I'll, maybe shall I go ahead and start about my own journey?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'll try to keep it brief. In high school, I studied violin all the way through since I was a small child. I grew up in the New York City suburbs. So I was lucky to have access to professional musicians in my hometown. One in particular who mentored me all the way through. And so I went, I was also fortunate to get into Harvard and so was able to go study music, which was what I wanted to do. It was either going to be Harvard or a conservatory. And so Harvard was a nice middle ground where I could explore my interests in music, but also get a liberal arts education.
Right.
And while I was there, I was just absolutely delighted with the amount of music that was going on in the undergraduate campus environment. There was a sense of kind of entrepreneurialism in the arts community there. And so students were starting ensembles and chamber groups. And it was just an incredible array of options. And I started my own orchestra. I learned conducting. I conducted several operas. I just got,
wow, that's exciting.
I immersed myself in everything I possibly could. I needed to work. So I worked in the music library. Harvard is an amazing place in the sense that they have an entire library just devoted to music.
That's awesome.
That was a great job. And another job I had was I went every Friday and served as a usher for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. So I would go on, you know, Friday afternoons, take the number one bus from Harvard Square into downtown Boston and go put on a little vest and go, help the elderly patrons to their seats and then sit in the hall and listen to the concert. So I did that for a couple of years. And after the concerts, I'd go have my violin lessons with one of the violinists in the orchestra. I had a rich classical music experience when I was an undergrad, and I was so happy there. I loved it. I think as I also progressed through those studies, I had opportunities here and there to experiment with a little bit of new music, which also had a great fascination for me. So like John Cage came and spent a whole year in residence with us. I learned a lot from John Cage. One of the last years of his life. So that was amazing. And that really kind of set me on a different trajectory. And we also had a new music conductor come, and he became a kind of mentor to me, Lucky Mosco. He was on a fellowship from CalArts, which was his usual teaching position. So Lucky was actually the person who helped me realize that if I wanted to conduct new music, I was going to have to learn something about electronics. I had avoided math and science. I liked math and science, but I was so invested in music, I had kind of ignored them. And he said, I was going to have to do something with that if I was going to have a future in new music. So he said, you know, there's this guy down the on the other side of Cambridge who is experimenting with a sensor glove for conductors. He said, I just went over there and, you know, played around with the device in his lab. He said, maybe you should take a look at that. So sure enough, you know, I took a gap year after college. I went to India for a year. And from India, I applied to grad programs. And one of them was to the MIT Media Lab, where this guy, Todd Mackover, was teaching. And that kind of changed my life, because I, at the time, Todd, who's a well-known electronic music composer, was experimenting with opera. So he needed somebody who knew something about operatic conducting, which I did. Not that many 23-year-olds had those kinds of experiences. Right. And so I was able to come in with some opera conducting training and musical training and kind of be the non-technical person on the team, which I did. And little by little, I picked up a little bit of computer science and, you know, engineering and sensors and this and that. So I was fortunate to have musical expertise at a time when that was needed. And that kind of got me in the door in terms of the other stuff. So when you ask about my background in computer science, it's a little bit embarrassing because it kind of happened after the fact. But I think it's important in when we're talking about the kind of disciplines we're talking about, that you go deep in at least one of them.
Right.
So for me, that was music. That was my first deep set of experiences. And the computer science and the technology, in a way, were vehicles for musical expression.
Yeah. And I mean, I think those are very relevant even to this day. I mean, obviously, technology right now, I mean, musicians would pretty much be nothing right now without things like Soundjack. I'm not sure if you've heard of that, but
sure.
Yeah. All the teachers giving lessons through Soundjack and CleanFeed. All these different technologies that teachers are relying on to be able to continue, you know, teaching their ensembles and continue teaching their lessons. You know, it's crazy how much of an overlap there's been just because of the last, you know, year and a half now.
Mm-hmm. And I think classical music in particular was very resistant to new tech until the pandemic changed the equation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I, that resistance is something that I've experienced in my teaching life. It's something that I kind of, struggle with a little bit, but it is interesting how the whole game changed a year ago, didn't it?
Yeah.
Right away.
Well, I mean, even in computer science, there's been a lot of course there's resistance with this too, but there's been a lot of talk of let's cut the term STEM and replace it with STEAM and include art in it. Because, you know, we've got these great scientists, but none of them can draw up a plan. We've got these great engineers, but none of them have any creativity. Mm-hmm.
There was a guy named John Maida who coined that term. He was a professor at the MIT Media Lab when I was a student there. And he went on to be the, I think, president of the Rhode Island School of Design, where I think that's where he coined the term. But yeah, that is a very helpful term, isn't it?
Yes.
To explain the synergies that are possible when the two connect powerfully.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely, steam is an area of great interest for me. And I often say that music is kind of the killer application for CS, because it makes CS concepts come alive right away, right? When you can demonstrate a CS concept like recursion or looping or something like that with a musical example, it can be very powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I absolutely see more and more people getting interested in computer science stuff just because of, you know, ties to multimedia and, mm-hmm. you know, what can we do with, you know, art that's, you know, something a computer scientist did that'll make that more interesting. And then you get people that are on both sides of the spectrum that are involved. And I think that's super cool, especially with more and more schools saying, hey, we're going to include computer science as a required class, but not necessarily require, you know, music or art, even right. though those are the most, you know, sort of chosen electives.
Right, right. And that they actually have been shown to be very, very important. But if we're not careful about it, it can harm our students if we set up these barriers and silos and keep the, you know, disciplines separate.
Right. So tell me about some of your research and some of your research interests, you know, some of the stuff that you're currently researching and hypothesizing.
Great. Well, until a few years ago, I would have told you that it was all, you know, focused on gestures and sensors and classical musicians. But starting about 5-6 years ago, I started to pivot away from that and look at social applications of music technology. So I started looking at locally here in New Jersey, we have a capital city called Trenton that has fallen on hard times. And I collaborated with a colleague to do a project called Trenton Makes Music, where we documented the rich cultural and musical life of the city over hundreds of years. And we put together some podcasts around that idea. And that was a really good project. So that was TrentonMakesMusic.org was a project from starting about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But most recently, I've been thinking about how there's been a lot of conversation in higher ed about music theory and about notation literacy as an unnecessary barrier to entry for students from underprivileged backgrounds. And so that was started me thinking that perhaps I could use some of my music programming and coding content to help teach music theory. So my latest project is I'm working on a book. And the goal of the book is to teach music theory principles, not through notation at all, but instead through the programming language called Max, Cycling 74 Max, and use it as a kind of a Lego-like constructionist way to visualize structure rather than thinking about musical structure through a notational lens. So that's very interesting. That's the current project. So thank you. So I'm working on that right now.
Yeah. Usually we see the opposite. You know, we see things like code.org that uses, you know, art and video games as a means of introducing, you know, some basic programming concepts, but the reverse being a teaching tool. That's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of students who have been denied access to higher ed music programs because of their limited ability to read notation. And I think it's a great shame. And I think a lot of the students do come from Black and Brown backgrounds. And that's really something that should give us pause as educators about whether we're in fact enacting, kind of false standards.
Right.
So I'm trying to get at that a little bit with coding. I also have a research project with some faculty at the Peabody Conservatory who are looking at how to teach conducting through VR. So that's
kind of fun. Awesome. That's super exciting. Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. So when I happened to find your research, I was like, man, I feel like I'm the only person in the world that's interested in this kind of stuff. Thank goodness I'm not the only one.
Well, there are a few of us, very few. There isn't a lot of money in it. So maybe that's what discourages some other people from pursuing it. But if you can make it work, it's a great topic.
Right. Yeah. And I find musicians are always interested in hearing about, you know, technology stuff in music. Like all of my professors, I've been telling them a lot about the stuff that I've been interested in, and they think it's interesting. You know, it's not, you know, over their head or anything like that. It's just no one introduced, you know, those core, you know, technological concepts to them before.
Right. It's sort of like a whole other field, a whole other culture.
Right.
Yeah. Good. So you have an important role to play as a music educator and a technologist, right? To educate your teachers and your colleagues about what is possible.
Right. And that's why I wanted to teach both. I was like, both of them are equally important in my opinion, especially music with, you know, the big change in, you know, writing across the curriculum. And all of these changes in literacy standards and all those different things, you know, there's great importance on both sides. And, you know, especially a lot of people, they don't really learn things very easily unless it's through something that they're interested in. And, you know, there's not too many people that aren't interested in music to some degree, I think. So there's always something you can teach them.
Well, necessity is the mother of invention. So needing to, you know, to teach remotely definitely increased everyone's attention on the tools that are available.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, could you tell me about your immersion music project?
Sure. Yeah. When I finished my PhD in very early 2000, I wanted to take some time to explore topics that had interested me and kind of pursue. The idea that I had was kind of a design studio for music technology. So Immersion Music was intended to be a kind of a production company that could design technical solutions for individual musicians or arts organizations or museums to help them incorporate music technology into what they were doing. So early on, I did some things like I produced a big concert with an orchestra in Boston called the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. That was we did a couple of big live events around music and tech. Then I collaborated with the Boston Children's Museum to design an interactive conducting exhibit for kids. And that's it utilized exciting. A video of the Boston Pops Orchestra. Yeah, it was great fun. It was wonderful to see children experiencing what it felt like to be a conductor. I learned from that. The Pops was wonderful. They stopped a concert in midstream, and Keith Lockhart just announced to the audience. He said, "We're doing this project for this group Immersion Music. So please, everyone, be quiet. We're going to record our signature tune, and we're going to donate it to this museum exhibit." So it was great fun to have the Boston Pops as a collaborating partner with that project.
Awesome.
So over the years, yeah, Immersion Music has been a kind of continued to be a design studio for all my outside projects. Anything that I didn't handle through the college, I did through Immersion Music, whether it was consulting or design or music composition, whatever. So that it kind of became a holding company for external projects, and it's been very helpful to have it.
Yeah, that's super exciting. Could you tell me about your dissertation? You discussed your conductor's jacket project. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that project and that research? How did that coincide with your digital baton project that you did as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, the digital baton came first. So I mentioned earlier that I went to work for Todd Machover at the MIT Media Lab. I became a master's student in his research group. And at the time, he was composing an opera called the Brain Opera, which premiered at Lincoln Center in 1996, so 25 years ago. And as part of his vision, he had a number of sensor MIDI instruments that we created for the piece. And one of them there were many, but one of them was the digital baton. And the idea was that you would have a kind of a three-dimensional mouse, sort of like a Wiimote, except, you know, before the Wii came out, with accelerometers in them and pressure sensors on the surface and a position tracking LED in the tip. And so we essentially built the Wiimote, it put it in a conductor's baton, and then it became part of the show. So we did almost 200 performances of the Brain Opera on, I think it was four continents over the period of 1996 to 98. So that digital baton, I was the primary performer for as well as the inventor of the instrument. And so I got to really intimately know my instrument over that period of time. I learned a lot from that. And I took from that, I started to develop the idea that maybe conducting isn't in the tip of the baton at all. I started to become a little bit disenchanted with it in a way that I started to realize, well, maybe, you know, maybe the tip of the baton is not where the meaning is and the information is. I started to think about the whole body of the conductor. And so that led me to the conductor's jacket. We, you know, started to ask lots of questions and realized we have no data. There's, you know, you can study conducting for years and never actually get data.
Oh, yes.
So the idea there was, well, what are all the signals that a conductor exudes when they're doing their art form? And I tried to capture as many of those as I could, given the sensors that were available to me at the time. So that included muscle tension sensors, respiration monitor, heart rate, conductivity, body temperature, and position. Of all the joints, as many of them as I could, anything that could fit inside a jacket. So the most extensive version of the jacket had about 16 sensors in it, and gathered data off of professional and student conductors while they were in front of orchestras. And it was a lot of fun. I gathered a heck of a lot of data, and I learned a lot from seeing different scenarios. In one case, I remember that the conductor was quite upset that the oboe is late to rehearsal, but he didn't show outwardly any sign of him being upset, but his what's called electrodermal activity shot up. So little things that are subtle, like, you know, sometimes when a conductor wants to broadcast an emotion, it's very measurable, but also sometimes when they're hiding an emotion, it's also measurable. So those are some of the things that I learned. I also saw that the professional conductors had refined their gestures to the point where they were very high, they were very rich in signal and low in noise. Whereas the students did a lot of extraneous activities like scratch their head or elbow or, you know, things that were not musical. And I saw that was readable in the data, whereas in the professional conductors' signals, there was very little extraneous motion aside from the musical activity itself.
Wow, that's really interesting. And yeah, that's a hard thing to even to collect data on, just because it's such an opinionated thing and it varies person to person. You know, piece to piece, you know, there's so many different factors that go into, you know, just deciding on how to express one gesture for one single beat in thousands of different contexts.
That's right. And you can go really, of course, nowadays with better software and sensors, you could go really deep on some of those questions, right? Yeah. I mean, the whole set of questions is, I think, fascinating. And I'd be curious to know what you would think would be interesting questions to ask with sensors and conducting.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things that you can track. And that's sort of what I've been trying to discover recently with sort of my research in machine learning stuff is my most recent research paper was on emotion detection in the singing voice. Just because there's so much stuff on spoken voice, but not so much on sung. And, you know, there's been so much interest in, you know, computer vision lately, stuff like the Xbox Kinect using decision trees to do full body motion capture without needing anything but just the two cameras and the sensor that's built into it. Right. I'd be interested to see what's more under the surface that we don't need to measure directly. Mm-hmm. Like with the voice, there's been a lot of research done on various different acoustic factors that show emotion, low-level descriptors, Mel frequency, Capstral coefficients, Delta coefficients, all these different things that are very, subtle and stuff that we can't even hear. But also there's so many different things that can change just in the way that an emotion is expressed from, you know, between how a person breathes, how deep a person breathes, how loud a person sings or speaks afterward, the tone mm-hmm. that they use, the color that they use, all those different things. And I'd be interested to see what kinds of things like that translate into gesture as well. So I've been delving into a little bit of semiotics recently and trying to understand gestures on a more psychological level.
You know, there's an ancient book that may interest you. I remember coming upon it when I was doing my doctoral research. It's called Chironomia, Chironomia. And I think it was a 17th century study of hand gestures and what they meant. And you might find it interesting in the sense that it tried to get at a kind of a universal language of gesture.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that stuff is super interesting, especially with the technology that we have these days for, you know, both wired and wireless sensors. I know like the New York Times did that one video, Conducting Demystified, that they put on YouTube where they mo-capped the wind ensemble director from Juilliard, I believe. And, you know, they showed all these different things with not only his gestures and how it related to the space, but also showing the results of the ensemble in response to all these different gestures.
Cool. I haven't seen that. I've got to go find it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that makes it especially interesting to me is you can't necessarily measure it just from, you know, the conductor themselves, but also from the ensemble and how the ensemble responds. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is making it super hard to do that kind of research, because you need data on both sides.
I did a big experiment with that in 2006, funded by McGill University with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And it was a massive project. Yeah. And, there were five members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra wore physiological sensors and the conductor, and something like 30 something members of the audience. So that paper is in Music Perception Journal in December of 2014. You can see that. But the best result I got from that data was showing that the conductor's heart rate varied significantly with it, temporally aligned with the score. And then it turned out that the audience members responded that their own emotional intensity was up and down in line with the conductor's heart rate variability. So
interesting.
It was a really interesting correlation between the audience emotion as self-reported with the conductor's heart rate, which was obviously not, the conductor didn't know what his heart rate was. maybe had some idea, but anyway, so there is some, you know, these are huge experiments to run, and of course they're not particularly they're complex. It's hard to rule out all of the factors so that you can say anything definitive with all of that data, but you might be able to construct an interesting experiment looking at the ensemble, the conductor, the audience, all simultaneously.
Yeah, and that's something I talked a little bit about on in my most recent paper, is just the fact that there's so many different things to measure. You really just need like a full like neural network amygdala just to measure half of the things that you need to understand these sorts of things, just because there's so much involved. So I think, you know, over time we'll slowly piece together a full sort of like semi nervous system neural network composed of all these different, methods of tracking different things, but also there's so many different things to track and so little data that we currently have.
Yes. And MIR is, and machine learning have done such wonderful things in recent years, but most of it's focused on Pandora and Spotify. And really they're not, they've just recently started to look at human expression from a kind of artistic perspective, which I think it's finally, they're getting to the good stuff, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. That was something I talked about in a paper I did last semester on, I did a paper on generative music using generative adversarial networks. Mm-hmm. And my hope was that I could narrow down what made it difficult for AI to compose more human-like music. Mm-hmm. So it really came down to just filtering data. I went from the full set of Paganini Capriccios, I'm sure you're familiar with as a violinist, to, you know, what's making it difficult from the full set to, if I narrow it down based on musical similarities and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that went into even just making, you know, less noisy data sets out of something that should have been, you know, full to begin with. Like Google did their little Bach chorale, Google Doodle thing, where you wrote a melody and yes. It generated the other three voices. But it wasn't very Bach-like. It didn't have very good counterpoint for sure. So my hope was to get a little bit more of an idea as to why that didn't happen. So yeah, there's so much research to be done with that stuff.
Yeah, if you look at David Cope's experiments in musical intelligence, there's a lot of good stuff there. I don't know if you've looked at any of his recent stuff.
I don't believe so. I think I've heard of the name and I think I might have mentioned it, but I don't remember his work.
He has some good YouTube clips of Bach style chorales that were automatically generated by his software. Mm-hmm. Worth taking a look at. Yeah, the voice leading and part writing is much closer to actual Bach.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much that goes into it. You know, how do we teach neural networks a full semester of music theory and counterpoint?
Yep.
With just a few weeks of training.
That's right. Good. You're engaging with really deep, really good stuff. Now keep going. This is wonderful.
Yeah. And again, you know, it just comes down to data sets being available.
Right. You know whose work you might also look at is Mary Farboud at NYU. Her is spelled M-O-R-W-E-A or Varied D. Farboud, F-A-R-B-O-O-D. You can see Mary's work that might be of interest to you.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. So what do you think about the relation between artificial intelligence and music from your own opinion? You know, things like, I know you did a little bit on training AI to conduct things like that. There's been a lot of stuff with like Eric Whitaker. His choir recently recorded some VSTs that were meant to almost replicate real singing, including vowel shapes and, you know, timbre and things like that, just in a VST coming out of a MIDI file.
Right, right. Well, you know, I have a sort of a weird relationship to AI. When I was a graduate student at MIT, I got to study with Marvin Minsky, one of the founders of the field of artificial intelligence. I got quite close with Marvin. Marvin loved music and had a lot to say about it. And so famously, you can read about his writings on music. And so a lot of what I learned from Marvin gets absorbed in the way that I think about things and the kinds of projects that I choose to do. But I also really, I can't really claim to be an AI researcher. I don't really use AI methods, but I think what I do in my work is kind of dance around the edges of AI.
Right.
you know, AI requires a lot of advanced machine learning. And so it's not, you know, it's not an area that I'm actively engaged in. But I think that it is, I think it's very important that things like music and creative arts are incorporated into AI, because I think there's obviously a lot of fear around the ways in which AI is headed. And I think ultimately our software tools need to serve us. And given that we're human beings and physical, we're physical, we have physical bodies, we have brains. I think AIs need to serve us. And so one of the ways in which we are uniquely human is in our musical behavior. So, so I think it's extremely important. What I want to say also, in terms of the current state of music technology in AI and in hardware, is I see it as a problem that we have a lot of closed commercial systems and not so many open-ended constructionist models. For me, the interesting stuff happens when you have open-ended systems like data acquisition cards or Arduinos or Raspberry Pis, right, where we can kind of get in there and change them to suit our needs. And when I get like a piece of hardware where it's all enclosed in a shrink wrapped surface and I can't get in there and mess with it, I struggle with that. So I think we need more tools that are open-ended construction platforms instead of these closed pre-designed systems. And I think AI gets at that a little bit too, right? In the sense we need flexible tools.
Yeah, that was something I talked about in my generative music paper, was there's some software that does it, but the majority of it is commercial. And even stuff that does like speech emotion detection, a lot of that stuff is commercial. And, you know, I think we're headed more towards an open source future with, you know, like Creative Commons license and the Apache license and things like that, where, you know, people will license their stuff, but, you know, the research is still there for people to learn. And I think that's important, you know, especially with big companies like NVIDIA, they're doing massive research and they could easily close off all of their stuff. But instead, they put out a research paper every like 3 days, pretty much with their CUDA and Jetson and all those different things that they're working on, which is awesome.
That's great. I see a slightly different trend that companies seem to be protected for obvious reasons around their intellectual property, which is a shame. But another area that I'm really interested in is sort of encapsulated in kind of Imogen Heap's gloves. I don't know if you've experimented with those yet, the Mimu gloves.
I have not. Could you tell me a little bit about them?
So Imogen Heap is a pop music vocal artist from the UK, and she's been designing these gesture sensing gloves basically for several years. They just became commercially available last December, and I was able to get a copy through a project that I'm working on, and they're wonderful. I really think that interfaces like those might be of great interest to you, particularly because they capture the gestural signals of the hands and fingers. They're very quite subtle, so I think you might be interested in maybe taking a look at them, as you know, instead of building your own kind of hand glove sensor interface for conductors. There's one out there now that you can use.
I actually just recently bought a couple Arduino Unos just to try and mess around with some accelerometer stuff, just to see, you know, what I could come up with and see, is this an ungodly amount of work? Probably. Yes. But I figured I'll see what I can measure just with a few basic things to see what's easily replicable.
Yeah, good. Well, you're moving in the right direction. I think, you know, don't be afraid of, you know, building your own hardware systems that to capture just exactly the thing that you need to get, right?
Right.
That's important.
Yeah. And you actually teach a lot of music tech stuff that I haven't seen at other universities really at all. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think more and more schools are going to start to expand and include music technology things? My university has a little bit of it, but not really much. But we have nothing to like. I know you teach an intro to programming for music class. And I think that's super interesting. I've never seen a lot of those things.
Thank you so much for your kind words about that. You know, I've been teaching at CNJ for years, so I've slowly built up that curriculum, and it is a pleasure to, you know, to really kind of have a complete curriculum for students to learn. So thank you for saying that. It is something I've worked at hard for many years. I've tried at TCNJ, which is, 100% undergraduate population, at least in my area. You know, I've tried to give the students a broad range of all the different areas of music tech, because as you don't need me to tell you, music tech is itself interdisciplinary, right? And there are all these different components, whether it's audio recording or production or multi-channel audio or composing for games and films, coding, as you mentioned, and of course research, like the stuff we've been talking about. So there are all these different components of music technology. And what I wanted to do is give the undergraduate students like a little introduction to each one of those areas, with the idea that if they decided to go to graduate school, that they could maybe go deep on something that maybe they only had one or two classes with me on. And that's worked fairly well. You know, I've been able to send students to big programs at Georgia Tech and elsewhere, where they've been able to, NYU is another one, where they, you know, can keep working much deeper toward a research project or whatever. Mm. So that's been my philosophy, is to try to be broad, but kind of also rigorous and hopefully enriching. And I think my focus, more than a lot of other music tech programs, is less on the science and tech and more on human expression. So enabling composers and performers and improvisers to be able to realize their art and their craft through technology as a tool, but not necessarily the be-all and end-all that they're right. aiming for. So balancing creativity with science and engineering, I tend to emphasize more of the creativity aspect and a little bit less of the science. At least it's the thing that suits my institution best.
Right. You think more universities are going to start to take that same route?
Well, the two models are, you either teach it in the context of an engineering program where you're teaching signals and systems and machine learning and MIR, or you're a composer. And I'm in a way neither, you know? So that's why I kind of straddle the middle there a little bit. I hope that, you know, I think the pandemic has in some ways created a problem for music technology at the college level, because suddenly music tech is now all about Jack Tripp and right? It's all about enabling other things. But I think it's helpful that I'm not a composer primarily, because I don't have a particular aesthetic agenda in what I teach. I try to teach a range of tools that support a range of styles. So I don't know what is coming next, but I do hope that the future of music technology looks a little bit more like what I try to offer in my program.
Yeah, hopefully so. I mean, especially with, like you said, because of the pandemic, there's been such a reliance for musicians to have access to technology in order to keep doing what they're doing. You know, all these choir, band, and orchestra directors, you know, if they're not doing stuff in person, their only other option is remote. Right. And, you know, some of them are forced into that position. So hopefully that inspires more people to see the value in tying both together.
Yeah. And I think they're very, very rich questions that can be asked and answered using the tools of music technology. You know? And I think really interesting work that remains to be done around, you know, how do you combine electronic instruments with acoustic instruments? And, you know, how do you make interesting music for video games that can be performed live on stage? You know, all those kinds of things I think are really fun to explore.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. On that same note, what do you think is the current state of music tech, both in like peripherals and also, you know, from a software perspective? Do you think we're behind, or do you think we're on the cusp of mm-hmm. something great?
I see that Europe's way ahead of the United States right now. I'm sure you've noticed that too. I think that European universities have made big investments in music technology that American universities have not, for the most part. So I think what's happening in Europe is I'm seeing a great emphasis on music information retrieval, machine learning applied to music, that wonderful program in Barcelona that is doing amazing stuff with audio processing and editing and pitch tracking, right? They're the ones who did the technology behind Vocaloid.
Oh, wow.
Amazing stuff coming out of the Barcelona. What is it called? The music research group in Barcelona, just beautiful stuff. So, anyway, I think that we in the United States, I think we're somehow tied to tradition in a way that's helping us right now. And I think the Europeans somehow, although they are the place where classical music was invented, seem to be able to get past it and free themselves and find new ways. The professor in Barcelona, his name is Xavier Serra, S-E-R-R-A. And he's just got an incredible amount of research that he's doing and work that's enabling creative expression. So I'm admiring of the work that's happening in Europe right now. And I think we need to emulate it for sure. And I think the kinds of things that are coming out in the United States are very interesting, but they tend to get swallowed up by large corporations, and then you never hear about it again.
Yep.
Like at Google, Google has hired so many really great music tech researchers, and we don't, we lose them.
Right.
So I think that's our problem that we need to solve.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that a lot recently. I feel like the further I get into college, the more I know that we know less. Mm-hmm. And it's such a strange phenomenon.
Yes.
It feels like we're so ahead of our time, but also we're way behind in technologies in a lot of ways.
Right.
As we've seen with COVID.
It's behind a paywall in a way, right? Or behind an IP wall. Yeah. There is a small group of audio researchers in the Northeast who are really open with each other. They call themselves, the acronym is NEMISIG, N-E-M-I-S-I-G. And they have these workshops and panels with each other where they share information. And they might be of interest to you. They don't put anything out online that's of much value, but if you attend their events, they have a lot of information to share, which I think is great. And they all work at big companies like IBM and Google and big places, Spotify, et cetera. Mm.
Interesting. So. Yeah. It's been interesting to see how much those sorts of companies have come out with their research as of recently. I think a lot of their biggest projects, they pop up here and there. Anytime IBM does something with quantum computing, it comes out. But, Google comes out with these very niche projects like, I don't know if you've seen their semiconductor project at all.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah,
it's just a little dinky computer vision website where you just wave your arms and it makes the sound change as if you're conducting. But, no one's talking about the research behind stuff like that. They're talking about, what is Google doing with, data warehousing and also with quantum computing. There's a lot of interesting stuff that, goes under the radar. Like you said, not a lot comes out.
Sadly. Right. Yeah. Right. So I like being on the other side of that because I rather have freedom to be able to the kinds of creative projects that I'd like to do and hang on to my IP.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But that's a tricky balance to strike.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the nature of things. On that same topic, what do you think about computer vision stuff? How do you think computer vision and things like music peripherals can help conductors specifically, either in training and or professionals that are already in the field? Do you think this might change how we teach gesture, for example, like as you mentioned with the virtual reality project?
Yeah. I think VR is very promising, especially the VR wands that are handheld. Computer vision is really interesting, except that usually its frame rates are too low.
That's true. That's very true.
So, 29.9 whatever frames per second just won't cut it. And even 60 is too slow. So you really need super fast cameras for computer vision to work for conducting, because the frequencies present in the conductor's gestures are much higher than that. and by Nyquist, right? You have to have the sampling be twice as fast as the highest frequency in the gesture itself.
Right.
So I haven't really done much with computer vision because of that reason. I know that there are faster cameras now, and I'm sure you can find ones that are fast enough, but they're expensive. So I've tended to, in my past work, do things like game controllers or infrared wands that can be used with a CCD camera, that kind of thing, where you can sample it at a couple, kilohertz, for example, instead of 60 hertz. You know, right. I definitely want to be sampling at least 2 to 4 kilohertz, just minimum, right? Just to gather a signal from a conductor. So let's see, that was your first question. The peripherals, as long as they are sampling, you know, at least a kilohertz or more, then
because by my simple estimates, the frequencies in conductor gestures are as high as 500 hertz in that range, because they're muscle based, and muscles have frequencies of at least 500 hertz. And so by Nyquist, you really need to sample at a minimum of 1 kilohertz per channel, however you're measuring it. And I haven't looked lately, but the cameras, the last time I checked a couple of years ago, really cameras were nowhere near what they needed to be.
Wow.
There's super expensive ones that you can get that'll do high frame rate.
Right. But even then, those just barely push that frame rate too. I know, mm-hmm. sort of like the big thing and like the super slow-mo videos is like just barely 1,000 frames a second.
Right. Right. And that was why infrared for a long time was sort of the preferred method. And that's what got baked into the Wii mode and things like that, because infrared could sit on the tip of a finger or, you know, sit in a palm. And then you could, instead of trying to track the whole video sequence, you just track a single point. And so that was the preferred method for a while.
Mm. Wow. Interesting.
And that sort of method you can see in the Leap motion sensors. Those little desktop interfaces. Have you seen those?
Yeah.
Those use IR and they're positioned right above the laptop. But so the problem with the Leap is that it really only gets maybe a foot cubed around your laptop. And that's really not big enough for conducting either.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. I guess I was speculating about VR, thinking that the handheld VR controllers would be more successful. Mm-hmm. But then they're too heavy.
Right.
So, you know, I think we're still kind of in the space of using mostly like specialized hardware or, you know, things rigged up just for that. The Polhemus was really interesting for a while, but that also didn't have the sampling rates that I needed. Have you looked at that?
I have not. Could you explain that a little bit?
That's just an old magnetic tracking system, very accurate. It was designed for the military, and it was basically the basis of motion capture systems.
Interesting.
Back in the day, they would use magnetic systems to track motion. And effectively, you have this little cube that you can tape to your hand or whatever that will get nice high degree of resolution in six degrees of freedom, but they tended to be sampled a little bit too low, but I think technically they could be sampled higher. I mean, there's nothing about the electromagnetic field that can't be sampled higher. So,
right. We just didn't have the power to support it at the time.
Mm-hmm. But that company is called Polhemus, Polhemus. They're still selling sensors. They're around. Those could be interesting. And of course, I mentioned the Imogen Heap gloves, the sensor gloves that she makes. Have you seen those?
Yeah, you were telling me about those.
Yeah, those are awesome. And they have a really nice interface, but they're not cheap. They're something like $2,000 for a pair.
Oh, yeah. That adds up quick.
It does. But those have nice accelerometers on the wrist and then stretch sensors on all of the fingers. So you can get this nice amount of sort of motor control. So if you're looking at legato versus staccato, you might, you know, you can get some of that kind of stuff.
That's really cool. Are you aware of like the Xbox Kinect and how that works?
Yeah. You mean with the camera?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was... that was something that we had talked a little about in my my machine learning class last semester, was how they ended up using decision trees based off of the infrared images that they were tracking, and mm-hmm. basically calibrating a little skeleton figure that would change based on these decision trees, which I thought was super interesting. I would have never thought that's mm-hmm. how they implemented something like that.
You know, there are a number of research papers that that sort of came out of Microsoft Research around the time when they were building that you could look at in terms of how they did it. But they do combine, as I understand it, traditional computer vision with IR, right? The IR kind of buys you some extra, it helps you make sense of the image. So
I think it's interesting.
And the great thing about IR is it can be sampled much higher.
Right. So you think that's probably our cheat for the time being, for the next some years, until we get some higher frequency cameras?
I think so. I mean, and IR is so versatile. It can be, you can use it as a sort of a broadcast, you know, it can be at the tip of a baton and broadcast out, or you can have reflectance, right? So it can be done in kind of active and passive modes. And you can send it in different directions as well. So I think it's a promising solution if you're trying to build your own sensor and, you know, do it right.
Right. Yeah, I know there's been a lot of research papers coming out recently with computer vision stuff, with people trying to make these little projects that sort of replicate the same thing just using a webcam. But you can see, you know, it's still super choppy, even just trying to, you know, track your hand over time or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And computer vision, it's gotten very good. But even simple things like occlusion and things like that can really throw off the algorithm.
Right. And especially having equipment like that would be affordable for a non-enterprise solution is mm-hmm. that's super difficult.
Right. But you're right, you know, to look at it as an option for like commercial off the shelf, you know, the Kinect Xbox combination is a powerful idea, right? That you can use it for motion tracking. You know, somebody once said to me, the trick with game interfaces is that Nintendo has like thousands of engineers working on the problem. And it's just little old you doing the research by yourself. So, right. You know, it's tricky when you want to do something novel with an existing commercial interface, that they know how to tweak it so that they can get the exact results the way they want them. But
right.
It's sort of a economies of scale problem.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I look at Microsoft Research all the time and see all the cool stuff that they come up with, but that's stuff that would take months of work with just one person compared to the stuff that they can put out in like a week.
Yeah. They're amazing. Yeah. One of their researchers, Andy Wilson, was one of my office mates at MIT. It's like really, really amazing work that he's done over the years.
Yeah. I think I read a couple papers from him last semester. The name definitely sounds very familiar, but that's really cool.
Great guy. Yeah. Really neat guy. Yeah. And great research. I think he worked on Kinect, and he also worked on the Surface tablet and a number of other interfaces.
Interesting. So to follow up with that, what do you think computer scientists can do to help musicians and vice versa?
Oh, it's a great question. Well, I mentioned to you that one of the professors I studied with at MIT, Marvin Minsky, was a great influence on me. And one of the funny things that he used to say was, it's interesting how mathematicians really need music, but musicians don't really need math that much. And I sort of have a similar response to that, which is that, you know, perhaps computer scientists need music more than musicians need computer science. but that's not a nice answer. So let me revise my answer and say, I think there's so much that we can learn from each other. I think what computer scientists have that musicians don't have is an understanding of signal processing and signals. and you know, DSP and signal processing for audio. These are powerful concepts that can be applied. You know, when you start to see a musician as a operator and start to analyze what are the signals that are being conveyed and expressed, then you start to get at the heart of what actually is music. You know, and so I think computer scientists are armed with the kind of tools that can help you understand at a deeper level what the function and behavior of music is. And most musicians really couldn't care less, because they're much more invested in the actual art of expressing themselves, and they know it when they hear it. So they don't really need to analyze it. They just know if it's right or not. Having said that, I think that musicians' lives can be enriched by understanding at a deeper level why they do what they do. And so I do think that the signal processing and analytical approach that computer scientists bring to the table can be very powerful. And I'm thinking a lot of the annual Izmir conference, where in recent years, it seems like some of the researchers who publish in Izmir are starting to think about the artistic process and the creative process, and think more deeply about why is it that we like this kind of music and not that one, and not just solving the Pandora and Spotify, you know, audience issues, but, you know, using computer science to go beyond that, to kind of inspect the nature of what it is to be human.
Right. Yeah, that's something I thought was interesting about the way that my university has my degree program set up, because I'm in choral music education, but even the vocal performance majors have to take the applied vocal pedagogy course. And, you know, that goes from everything between, you know, not just the anatomy of the instrument, but also the physics of the instrument, the physics of the sound behind the instrument, the physiology of all of the things, all of the inner workings of, you know, resonant frequencies, and, you know, all of those fun
overtones.
Of those sorts of things. Cause those, you know, those apply more to singers than, you know, to other instruments. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a string player, so I can, I'll defend that a little bit, but I always think it's interesting how much more of an understanding we have to know of the physics side of things as singers rather than just as instrumentalists. Because as far as I'm aware, there's no similar course for instrumentalists. Obviously, they take their pedagogy and methods classes, but nothing to that sort of, you know, science and application style.
Yeah, and you need to understand acoustics. There's so much that we do almost intuitively in music that we really don't introspect on. And when we do turn on that part of our brain, there's so much wonderful stuff that can emerge from that deeper understanding. So, you know, I am, although I started with a snarky attitude, I have to say I am really a proponent of interdisciplinarity on a deep level. And I think that the more that we can talk to each other across these disciplines, the more enriched, more fulfilling the experience can be, you know, but the more people you add to any equation, you also add complexity.
Right.
So, as I've learned in my career, sometimes less is more. but sometimes you have there's so much you can learn from the other way of seeing things. So yeah, I've used computer science and engineering techniques to analyze music in my work. And, I always feel like I was glad I did. You know, early on when I was looking at some of these questions, people would say, well, that takes away the mystery of it, because now if I know how it works, then I won't like it as much. Right. And I haven't found that to be true.
Right.
The more I understand it, the more I enjoy it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
So science doesn't take away the magic of music.
Right. Especially with how subjective it is.
Yeah, we're never going to really get to the root of the matter. So, but we can understand around the edges.
Right. Yeah, that's what I've always thought was really interesting is, I've been in my form and analysis class and just like trying to make sense of why certain notes were put in the way that they were, or why a certain phrase was repeated. in one spot, but not in another. You know, those minuscule details that seem unimportant without years of study to actually know why it's significant. And, mm-hmm. you know, having all of the music history knowledge and theory knowledge and all of those different things. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that a lot earlier, just how intricate music is. And the more that you learn about the study of it, the more it starts to make more and less sense at the same time, I think.
Yes, that's right. And the source of it becomes less and less clear, right? Why do we even do this? Why, why do we even have this behavior?
Right. Yeah. And I think
it's so important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting to see how many like music related technology tools have come out in recent times. Mm-hmm. Like there's been a lot of like spectrographic tools for singers coming out. There's been a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, music training tools. All sorts of different things dedicated to, you know, trying to make practicing music and learning music as easy as possible with things like Smart Music and Aurelia and Music First and all those platforms.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the increase, it feels exponential, like especially with COVID, our awareness anyway of all these tools out there has expanded tremendously. And yet it's funny, my students complain bitterly about Smart Music and they found it to be a torturous experience in high school. Many of them, I wonder, did you ever use it in high school?
No, but I did early on in college and I really enjoyed it just because I never learned how to read sheet music until I got into college. So it just made more sense to me to, you know, hear the notes and have something to work along with. And I was like, wow, this is an amazing piece of software.
Yeah. And, you know, it was that was invented by Roger Dannenberg. That was yet another one of Roger's inventions. Mm. That one became commercial in the case of Audacity, which he also invented. He gave that away for free to the world. Yeah. But one guy is responsible for quite a lot.
Yeah. And that's what I think is really interesting, too, is there's so much research that comes out of music related things that can apply to a large scale of plenty of other stuff. Like anything that's related to music research is also, you know, anything related to audiology and, you know, signal processing, like you mentioned. You know, there's so many different ways that you can take music research, even just like, you know, I could do computer vision research just by having a neural network learn to read a score and analyze mm-hmm. a score. You know, it still benefits both sides, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And it helps teach us also about the nature of learning, right? The way our brains work, how we parse time. There's so much that you can learn from training a neural network in that way.
Right.
Yeah. That's cool.
So what sort of, and especially from your experience as a director, what sort of technologies do you think would help professional ensemble directors these days?
You know, aside from the ones that help with remote performance, which for the most part don't work well enough. I have two thoughts. One is my friend Young Woo Kim at Drexel University had used MIR techniques to track a live concert performance of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and his app allowed the audience to read the program notes in real time, and the program notes were synced up so that when, you know, as the orchestra progressed through the program notes also progressed. So it was a really
awesome.
Cool idea. Yeah, I love that. It was I think it was called EndNote. I think it may still be available as like an iOS app. And I don't think that's answering the question that you were asking, but you know, a lot of orchestras still prefer to perform music of the, you know, 18th, 19th and early 20th century. And so they're not thinking necessarily about integrating technology into the act of performing itself. So that, you know, that's thinking about kind of something on the margins where it's mostly for the audience.
Right.
But if you're asking about what can they actually do for integrating technology, I had an experience with the Boston Pops in 2017 that was really exciting. And basically what we did, I wonder if there's much about it online, probably not, but I was invited to produce an animated real-time sort of in visual sort of the idea. The concept was like Fantasia live, but where instead of using pre-animated Disney characters, we would use a game engine and animate the variables in the game engine to reflect some qualities of the music. So that I think things like that, where you're not changing the music itself, but you're enhancing it with visual, you know, entertainment for the audience. I think those kinds of things are very promising for modern audiences. And it wasn't that hard for us to pull it off. It didn't take us that long. I mean, once I had a collaborator who had a game engine, then all I had to do was rig up a Max patch that could read in audio coming off of the stage and figure out what notes are being played, you know, do pitch tracking, which is a known thing. And then I had a MIDI controller, an APC-40 that was rigged up to trigger certain MIDI commands at moments in the score. So I sat there with the score, and when the orchestra got to rehearsal letter A, I pressed a particular number on my controller, and that caused an effect to happen in the visual. So, you know, conceptually, it wasn't that hard to pull off. You know, aesthetically is another question, but I think opportunities for the music itself to drive the visual, I think, is something that orchestras should be paying attention to. I think in the usual way, orchestras might perhaps do an evening of video game music or film music or that, something like that. And then the poor conductor has a click track in their ear and is just a slave to the click.
Right.
And I think the whole point of classical music is that it's not on a click. And so I think having the music drive the visual is the correct order of operations. And that's something that I think is quite doable from a technical perspective.
So, yeah, that's really interesting. Like a very like synesthesia inducing experience.
Yes, that was the basic idea. And let me share with you, maybe you already saw this on my, I don't know if you went to my college website, but I'm just going to.
I did look on YouTube. Was it the video you had a like a violinist playing, I think, or was it one with you conducting? I did see both of those.
I've done different versions, but the violinist was from quite a few years ago. But here is the one with the Boston Pops. And the only problem with working with the Boston Pops is that you cannot use, you cannot really film what you do because everything that they do is kind of very protected. So this is a cell phone video from the audience.
Oh, yes, I did see this video. I was looking at that a couple of days ago.
So that's, you know, and I have some other videos. If you were interested, I could share with you what it looked like from the control position of in terms of controlling how the animation progressed, because we had direct control over the movement of the boat and the light on the boat and characters in the scene and things like that. Even weather, like we turned the weather to a storm at a particular stormy section of the piece, et cetera. So we had lots of really neat controls over what exactly happened in the scene. And we could drive those variables as the orchestra was performing. So I think more things like that would be really fun.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And especially for people that aren't really used to sort of the depth of like, you know, absolute music, which doesn't really have a story per se to it. But, you know, someone with years of collegiate experience studying music can make something out of it. But, you know, an audience member isn't constantly thinking about that sort of thing in their head if they're just a casual listener. So right. Something like that. You know, it's really interesting that it actually gives it somewhat of a story to actually, you know, drive alongside the music and not necessarily take over. Like I've seen, like my university has an improvisers orchestra where they'll have the reverse, or they'll have a video and then they'll play to whatever's on the screen.
Right. Right, which is also equally fascinating and worth pursuing, right? You should try all of these different permutations and combinations are worth exploring. I don't think they're explored enough.
Right. Yeah. It was really interesting because they had a bunch of stuff from like abstract art and video games and movie trailers and all these different things that they had played along with. And it was just really interesting to see everyone try to make something cohesive out of, you know, something that's not very concrete.
Yeah. And it exercises the imaginations of all the performers in a way that's very different from reading the notes off the page.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So
there are some ideas. We didn't really get into like new composition, but of course there's lots of opportunity for new composers to work with technology. It's just that I think the ensembles themselves tend to be a little bit hesitant to commission new works in this area. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's a given thing, you know, some directors are always going to be kind of strident towards, you know, romantic and baroque era music more than more avant-garde stuff. I'm a little bit of the same way. I'm not too toward contemporary stuff, but I'm not against it for a lot of them. There's been a lot of cool stuff. And especially with, you know, a lot of like video game music that does a lot of interesting things that most regular classical music wouldn't do otherwise. So I think there's composers. A lot of opportunity.
Yep. And there are composers like Steve Mackey who try to combine rock and roll with orchestras, you know, so it's not necessarily horribly dissonant and hard to listen to. It may in fact be quite fun and raucous.
Right.
So, you know, there've been a lot of orchestral pieces and Frank Zappa wrote several that were very, you know, they're very fun and hip. That could be really well supported by electronics.
Right. That's true. We don't have an advanced theremin of today yet.
Although we have a wonderful performer. What is her name? There's a up and coming German thereminist who is fabulous. And she's good enough to be performing with major symphony orchestras. Carolina Eyck. You should look her up. EYCK, I think is her last name, but she's making the rounds of the performance circuit, but there's like one concerto for theremin.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right. Exactly. What direction would you like to see non-technological music research go?
Ooh. And what do you mean by that? Like qualitative research?
So anything regarding, you know, like either like a musicology or music theory or anything along those lines, analytical style research.
Well, if you look at some of the national fora around like organizations like College Music Society, what you see is that several of those disciplines are right now engaged in very deep reflection around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think that's really important work to be doing. So I'm glad that they're doing it. But I think as a result, they're very distracted from like new things because I think really reforming ways of thinking and being is probably the number one thing that needs to happen. There's just decades and millennia of missed opportunities. So I think you'll see a lot of discussion around that. Having said that, I think also simultaneously the pandemic and the rise of technology has really thrown those disciplines for a loop because in the past they defined themselves in opposition to technology. And so now they're being forced to reckon with the results of that decision. I don't think we're past it yet. I think those disciplines are trying to figure out their relationship to technology. And both those two things, the diversity question and the technology question, are going to take a while to resolve.
That's very true. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to digest in that, especially like you said, there's years of things that have gone just stagnant over time that no one's thought to resolve. And especially, you know, all of the sort of like hygienic practice things that we wouldn't have even considered until, you know, today.
Yeah. Even things like, you know, musicology, I guess it's challenging. I think, well, what I want to say is that the new tools that are available for scientific analysis of music offer a whole new set of vistas from which, you know, you know, whole new ways of seeing and analyzing music can happen now. But I think that those MIR researchers aren't really talking to the musicologists yet. And I think that's a big opportunity that needs to happen.
Right.
So yeah, let's hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It is really like a rise in interdisciplinary stuff at the moment.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. I think it's great that more and more disciplines are starting to actually come together to do, you know, conglomerate research rather than, you know, the biologists will work on biology, the musicologists will work on music. And, you know, now we have, you know, musicologists working with biologists to try and figure out something that helps both of them equally.
Yes. You know,
it's super cool how everyone's finally branching together because of COVID and, you know, advancing research really, really rapidly compared to what we were before.
Yeah. Have you followed any trends in the field of computational musicology recently? I haven't, but.
I haven't. I've seen a little bit of stuff on it, kind of on and off, but.
I haven't followed it lately, but I'd be curious. And I remember that people like David Huron at Ohio State were really, David in particular was a pioneer in this area. And I think he recently retired. So I don't know who's kind of leading the charge these days, but I think that computational musicology idea of fusing data science, computer science, you know, information retrieval, machine learning with traditional disciplines like musicology, those are really, I think, the future of the field.
Yeah, absolutely. So my other question alongside that was, do you think there's anything that deserves sort of top priority in research for music and computer science?
Well, I find in my, you know, in the, it's going on 30 years now that I've been thinking about these kinds of questions. I find that I alternate between phases of research and phases of creativity. And in recent years, I've been emphasizing creativity. So I guess if I had to say, what I would say is that if I had to pin it down, I think I have more fun when I do the creative projects. And so for me right now, I think the world needs a little bit more fun as we open up out of COVID. Right. I think that I would rather focus on creative projects that allow people to express themselves freely. Because I think ultimately that's what music is for. So I think for the, at least the next phase, I would emphasize science in the service of creativity rather than science analyzing what the creatives do.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. You gotta have an equal balance of both.
Yeah. I think we need a little inspiration and excitement. We need more live performance, obviously, than what we've been able to do for the last year. So that's where I would put my energies, is on enabling really cool, interesting forms of live performance where people can actually be proximate in the same spaces.
Yeah.
I love the stuff that I did with the Boston Symphony, in 2006, where I put, physiological monitors on the, I told you about this, about the audience and the orchestra and all that. And I think I would, you know, I would be interested to see what we could do artistically with that data now, instead of just analyzing it. What if we leverage that data to produce a whole new set of experiences, whether interactive graphics like Fantasia or whatever. You know, I think let's get a whole bunch of people in a space and put sensors on them and see what, what we can do with that for our own delight, you know, and our own kind of, our own edification and that deep satisfaction that comes from artistic expression.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, everyone is really in the need of rebuilding self-efficacy after the year and a half, 2 years that we've had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need some therapy, all of us.
Yeah. Yep.
And I really appreciate your podcast in this way of, you know, having a dialogue conversation with an unknown person to kind of see where the good ideas are. I think it's a wonderful idea that you're doing, and I admire it, you know, and I think you should keep it up and maybe find ways of having those conversations face to face, right?
Yeah. You know, that's as soon as we get beyond this little hurdle, that's what I'm hoping for. I'd love to just, you know, have time to sit down and talk to people that are, you know, working on, you know, these high level projects and really interesting topics in super major fields like technology and, you know, contemporary music projects and all those sorts of really interesting things that don't really get as much public attention as they do sort of people that are, you know, in the more niche fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the great discoveries of Zoom was that it became super easy to invite famous people into your classroom, which was so great. We've had some real, really exciting class settings where we've had, you know, famous composers come in, and I had Thomas Dolby visited my electronic music class, and it was just, you know, just incredible things that happen with Zoom. And yet, you know, that kind of authentic face-to-face interaction is something that I still miss, you know. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah. It's, we've definitely seen the rise in master classes, which has been cool.
The webinar as a, you know, format for our lives. Yeah. But I think I've run away from webinars as soon as I possibly can.
Yeah. I think everyone will.
Great. Well, I hope this has been helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been super inspiring. I've been thinking about all the different things that we've talked about. It's just been spiraling with ideas. You know, there's so many interesting things to, you know, look forward to in, you know, future research and future technologies and all of those fun things.
That's great. Yeah. And what you'll discover as you go into all of this in more greater detail and greater depth, that technology is just a tool like any other, like a violin or a flute or whatever, or a voice, right? And that technology can be applied in many different ways. It can be, sometimes you apply it in a very small way, like my Trenton Makes Music project, where really we just use the technology to record people's stories and, you know, basically give them a microphone and document what their musical practice was. And then sometimes you do a full blown, you know, like no holds barred, you know, 400 computers on stage with the right. And, you know, and it really just, it depends on the application you have to choose based on the context. And, you know, it becomes a design decision, you know, that you're tailoring your design for the scenario that you're, you know, the data you're seeking to gather or the outcome that you're seeking.
Yeah. And I think musicians in the classical world are starting to become more accepting of technology, not just because of COVID, but I've definitely seen the rise of, you know, performers playing with, you know, iPads and Bluetooth pedals to turn pages and all those things. That's been, you know, massively popular in the last, you know, couple of years. So I think people are finally starting to be more accepting of technology on the stage, which is a really interesting direction.
Yes. So the sky's the limit for you. I think, you know, I think you can start to imagine a future in which you're kind of inventing scenarios that are going to enable other people's performances to happen. Or, you know, I'll be curious to see how you end up deciding to pursue these different ideas.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I hope we'll stay in touch. I hope you'll, when, as you publish new papers and stuff, I hope you send them to me.
Yeah. I'll definitely keep you in the loop with any more interesting stuff that I come up with. I've been kind of branching off ideas, trying to decide what to do for my master's thesis. But, you know, there's so many options to choose from. It's hard to narrow it down to one. So once I start to build up a committee, I'll have to have someone yell at me to finally make a decision so I stop procrastinating. Just because there's so many options to choose from.
Well, I'll be very happy to hear from you. If you ever want to chat about any ideas, I'd be happy to brainstorm those with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Dr. Knocker, thank you so much. This has been, you know, absolutely enlightening and super inspiring, to say the least. It's been really great to have you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been my absolute pleasure, and I look forward to staying in touch.